Hey, this is Jim McDonald. Before we get started, I want to remind everybody to leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. We really appreciate those. Also, please support our sponsors, BSN, HowMuchABench.net, ThePowerMagazine.com, and CavemanCoffeeCo.com. This episode is also brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at ThePowerCast.com/audible. That's ThePowerCast.com/audible. If you listen to a lot of podcasts, you might want to try checking out an audiobook every once in a while to help feed your brain a little bit more, I don't know, organized fashion than we can do here. And now let's start the music.
We gotta get a new intro. Maybe he could do our intro.
His voice is pretty deep.
Yeah, it's just as good as Nickerson. Nickerson's off the team, so.
It's not quite as deep as Nickerson.
I could be doing that.
Yeah. Just for the ladies. Nina.
It's a little froggy, too. Not only is it deep, but Nickerson's froggy. He's got like a Kermit the Frog on steroids voice.
Or the WB frog.
Yeah. What's up with that frog? The Broadway frog.
Yeah.
He dances and shit.
Yeah, he's talented.
He's got the cane.
Yeah, a little jacket. No shirt, just a jacket.
He's got a name. I can't remember what it is, though.
Yeah, but that guy, that dude in Spaceballs is the same thing, the alien that pops out of the guy's stomach. Remember that?
Yeah, that's amazing. Come on, my darling.
Yeah, oh, my baby. Yeah, and he dances on his tail. The big, like, lizard alien thing?
Michigan J. Frog.
Michigan J. Frog.
I thought it was going to be Michael J. Frog. That would be pretty funny. That'd be a great fucking thing.
He does have a little bit of Michigan colors. He got the yellow in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, why is his name Michigan?
I don't know.
Yeah, some of these things just go unspoken, like Winnie the Pooh has no pants. And a shirt that's way
Winnie
too small.
Winnie the Pooh is obviously gay. There's no question.
Whoa, no.
His voice?
Who's he gay with? Piglet? Or is it Piglet?
He's gay with anybody he can find, I think.
Hey, Christopher Robin, I think.
He's always looking.
Oh, Christopher Robin. What happened to that kid? He had the shittiest life talking to stuffed animals all day.
He's probably crying in the shower somewhere about the things that Winnie the Pooh did to him.
Yeah, Teddy Ruxpin's kind of gay, too.
Teddy Ruxpin is gay. I read it like Teddy Ruxpin in the box or something's worth 10 grand right now.
Really? I believe it.
What about just Ted? How much is he worth?
Ted 2 coming out soon.
Yeah, I know.
Is Ted making fun of Teddy Ruxpin? I never really thought about that, but it has to be, right?
Probably so.
Probably.
Yeah.
Ted looks awesome.
Yeah, Ted's good. Who's the voice of Ted?
It's Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote it and directed it.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So good.
All right. Well, I want to apologize in advance to all the listeners because of...
Turn your subwoofers down because your speakers might blow.
Well... I want to apologize in advance. The last few podcasts, we've actually been giving out information, and I'm really sorry for that. And this one will probably have like usable information as well. And I just wanted to apologize to everybody out there because the show is supposed to be about nothing, but it doesn't end up that way.
Yeah, sometimes we have smart people on, and we feel we have to take advantage.
We're here with Juggernaut Chad Wesley Smith, and hopefully he can help us clear up some bullshit for us. About programming and strength training and being a sex symbol in powerlifting.
International sex symbol.
International.
Oh,
man,
wow,
of
really?
Mystery sex symbol.
Wow. It's overseas as well, huh?
I mean, the things they were talking about were pretty weird, so they must have been from Europe.
Mm. Hey, now.
China or something. Who knows?
European men.
I like the sounds of that. Let's start out talking a little bit about your jugs here. How did Juggernaut start? peck pop. For
that
those
was pretty
who can't
good,
see,
yeah.
He just gave us a fucking wonderful peck popping.
We're all wearing baseball shirts, too. We're the fattest guys wearing baseball shirts.
573-pound bench worth or 584? What did you do?
67.
567. There we go.
Kilos are still.
567-pound peck popping. Anyway, how did Juggernaut start, and what is this thing all about?
Yeah, so Juggernaut started in September 2009, kind of right after I graduated college.
Mike was just born.
2009? No. You're not that much older than me.
Yeah,
I'm around.
And really was just focused on in-person sport performance training. Had a facility down there in Laguna Hills in Orange County,
AKA
California.
AKA performance-enhancing drugs. Okay, go ahead.
And I never really had any aspiration at the time to just talk about lifting on the internet as I do now. But from 2009 through 2012, we're really just focused on training athletes, high schoolers, college, some professional, mostly football, MMA, a little baseball and so forth. But during that time, I'd also written the Juggernaut Method, the original one. And that kind of opened my eyes to the possibilities of teaching people about lifting weights on the computer.
So people took to it pretty well?
Yeah. Surprisingly, well. I released it right after I had done my first powerlifting meet, which is probably like a lot of old.
Is that when you squatted a 905 in like an SPF meet or something like that? Was that?
First meet was a USPA meet. Actually, first ever USPA meet. And I squatted 800. I did 800, 462, 700 at that meet. So 1962 total. And came out with the Juggernaut method, which is what I used to train for that meet and what we'd been using for a lot of our athletes at the gym. And, yeah, like I said, that just kind of opened my eyes to how much bigger and broader the reach could be, you know, doing videos and writing articles and all that kind of stuff. So really in 2012, fall of 2012 is where we made the shift to more what the company is about now, which is just educating people about, you know, powerlifting, weightlifting, training, nutrition, movement. You know, I was trying to reach a very broad audience, and what I'm trying to do is give a great platform to true experts, you know, coaches and athletes who are living it day to day. You know, not just people who write articles and stuff, but actually the guys who are all about it. And
do you think training can be broken down similar for most people? I mean, just you know, in terms of like the intensity, the volume, the frequency, you could probably break it down for any sport, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's kind of like the book we just came out with, Scientific Principles of Strength Training. Mostly by Dr. Mike Isertel. I wrote like a chapter.
There you go.
Put me on the cover
for the way. That's the way to do it.
Put me on the cover for the sex appeal.
Yeah.
Got to know what sells.
Yeah, you got to sell books.
And, but that's really what that kind of thing is about, are these, you know, principles that will guide programming for really any sport or any goal. And that if you have an understanding of them, it goes well beyond, you know, this sets and reps, because, you know, a certain set rep scheme, it might work. It might work great, but it's going to only have a temporal effect. And once that stops working, if you don't understand the principles that guided why that was working, you're not going to be able to make an informed decision for yourself.
Right.
And it'd probably be a better business model if I just sold the program, because when that one stopped working, they'd have to buy another one.
Yeah.
Rather than trying
principle,
to teach people.
Principle of awareness is crucial.
Yeah.
You got to know what the hell's going on.
Yeah. Rather than just trying to actually teach people how to do it for themselves. But
yeah, people don't want to learn.
Yeah.
They want to be told what to do.
But, yeah, so since that time in 2012, been very fortunate to connect with a lot of great athletes and coaches across these different sports and different areas of expertise. Gotten to travel a lot, doing the clinics and everything, and, yeah, lift some weights along the way as well.
1962 totals where you started. Where are you at now?
23-14.
God damn. That's a crazy improvement upon an already big total.
Yeah, so I've actually only done, I think, 11 meets now. Well, was fortunate, you know, because of my genetics and giant knees and stuff, to be a talented lifter. Transitioned from, I was a shot putter previously.
What was the training like for that?
Throwing heavy balls was a...
Heavy balls. You're into heavy balls. All right.
Primary part of it.
That's not a first.
Are they not big? They're just small heavy balls?
Very dense. Very dense. Hey.
My type of man.
But, yeah, just...
You started doing that as a kid?
Yeah, I actually started throwing the shot put when I was 8 years old.
Wow.
Jesus.
And it was track and football all the way through high school.
That's kind of rare for an American kid, right?
Yeah, were your parents into it or something?
No. Yeah, growing up, my main sports were...
Somebody just saw him and said, that kid's head is fucking huge. He's going to throw the shot put. God damn.
Yeah, I was soccer, basketball, and track. But even in track, I was a sprinter and a shot putter until I was 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And because I didn't really get big until I was in high school.
Were you pretty good at sprints? Did you win some races?
Yeah, we were Southern California, or California 4x100 meter relay champions.
Oh, damn.
Those four little white boys from Irvine. You know.
Is that pretty... So strength and speed are related, huh?
A bit.
Is that pretty common in Southern California, track and field at a young age? I know up here I think it's just like high school. People do basketball, soccer, baseball, football.
Track's like an afterthought a lot of times.
Yeah, and then, oh man, you're a pretty good wide receiver. Come play track or come run.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think youth track scene, at least being in it, seemed like it was really big. I mean, we'd be at meets every weekend in L.A. and San Diego with hundreds and hundreds of competitors.
Wow. Right.
Go to youth nationals, youth worlds, all that stuff. But the training for the shot put was just much more athletic, explosive training, you know, throwing, sprinting, jumping, and then the lifting is just a complement to that. But it made the transition to powerlifting really easy because more or less I got to cut out half of my training.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't have to...
cut out the athleticism and throw in the power, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You, like, squat, bench, dead, power clean or something like that?
Yeah, I had never really trained the deadlift much before I started competing in powerlifting. And Olympic lifts for most throwers are very, very common. I didn't do a lot of those towards the end of my throwing career because I controlled my own training. I just kind of felt they beat up my wrists and elbows too much.
Did you go to a box jump or something to kind of replace it?
Yeah, so I just sprint and jump and then throw. And because telling Mark when we were driving over here, I kind of miss being athletic. Now I can just stand in one place and lift a bunch of weights.
Do you do any of that to help your powerlifting out?
The first couple of years of competing in powerlifting, I was still doing a lot of jumping, and I think that it can have a great benefit, and particularly more intermediate lifters. As you get more and more advanced, you need to do more and more specific training, and the jump, even though it can have a high carryover, is still relatively general exercise compared to the squat. I ended up cutting them out because I had a back injury, two herniated discs, two summers ago, June 2013. And so when I came back from that, I was like, I just didn't really want to take the time to get back into jumping shape. And when you weigh 350, you know, jump's a little more taxing on the joints.
Your shape is more round.
Do you think it was less necessary, too, just because you're kind of explosive already?
Yeah, definitely. And that would go with, you know, any kind of speed work or dynamic effort work. Like, if you're already fast, you probably don't need to do it. You just try and move every weight as fast as possible.
What do you think jumping can do for somebody who's, you know, particularly just trying to increase like their squat?
It's going to, I mean, teach them how to accelerate. It's going to teach them how to more quickly recruit motor units.
Right. Do you recommend that to a lot of people in their training? Probably depends, I would imagine, but yeah, is it something that's often in the juggernaut programming?
Yeah. I mean, the training for athletes, so, you know, say athletes, I mean, non-strength athletes,
right?
Team sport athletes, they're always jumping. Their training is going to be based around sprint, jump, throw, and then the lift is the complement. I haven't been using the jumping as much in a lot of the people I train now, just because I've had the opportunity to work with more and more advanced lifters.
Right.
Like I said, it's a bit more of a general exercise, but it could fit in into the training, you know, like an entire training plan, like an annual plan.
It may be easier to throw in something like that if you're actually physically coaching somebody as well, rather than just like, you know, throwing it out there to some kid who's going to be doing all kinds of crazy shit that you're not actually supervising.
Yeah, definitely.
What was your progression of body weight from, like, you know, freshman in high school to powerlifting?
I was 300.
When I was a freshman in high school, I was about 5'8", 5'7", maybe 170 pounds, 175 pounds.
Okay.
And when I graduated high school, I was 6 foot, 275. Did my first powerlifting meet as a light 308. I weighed about 298. And then spent about a year and a half kind of bouncing between 300 to 320, but still competing as a 308.
Mm.
And then when I made the transition to competing in strongman in 2012, that's when my weight started to increase a lot. You know, part of that was like an intention to get heavier because I'd look at, you know, guys who weigh 400, 450 pounds, like, well, probably need to weigh a little bit more. And also, I think strongman is just a great way to build muscle because, you know, you do a squat, let's say, you know, at the time I'd squat 900 pounds, that bar was on my back for maybe 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do a 900-pound yoke walk and that bar is, you know, that weight's on
your back. 30 seconds or something.
Yeah. And you can just, you know, have really, really high load time under tension for longer, you know, for longer amounts of time. It's going to force you to build more muscle. So that's when I got up into 335, 340. And the last meet I did, I weighed 363. But most of the time but competing between 345 and 360.
Strongman is difficult, and it just, for lack of a better term, just fucking hurts.
Yeah.
You know, so the discipline for strongman probably carried over really well to powerlifting as well.
Yeah, you know, I tried to kind of do the same style of training for strongman that I do for powerlifting, which is a lot of submaximal work and just, you know, focusing on...
What's submaximal work? What's that mean?
So submaximal work is going to be mostly, you know, sub 90% intensity. So
between 85 and 90%, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll even do a lot of work from 60% to about 85% is sort of
and
my...
And what rep range?
It varies, but, yeah.
3 to 6 or something like that.
Yeah, it's varies more. Like, I'll get up into doing sets of 8 to 12, sometimes 15 reps, even in the squat and bench. And then as we get closer and closer to the meet, just continuing to taper down. And
that's not all that common from the strongest guys in the world to do, you know, high reps like that. Why do you incorporate that?
Well, you know, reps build muscle, and muscle is what lifts weights. And doing high reps, particularly squatting and deadlifting, it sucks and no one likes to do it, but yeah,
that's hey, it works gonna, for Jesse Norris.
Yeah, seriously.
When did you get interested in programming? Obviously you think a lot about it now, about different program structures and, you know, what works, and, you know, when did that light bulb come on?
Yeah. With the exception of maybe 2 years out of my entire training career, which really, you know, lifting career, which started when I was 14, I've written my own program since I was 14 years old.
So what a nerd.
Yeah.
Something that just That's always cool. interested me. And, you know, so back in 2000, 2001, like, there were not resources online like there are today.
Right.
So I was still, you know, Googling stuff, or Google was around then, I think.
Let's check your phone and see what you're Googling.
Yeah. Yeah. Just trying to Google all these different programs. Yeah. And I, you know, looking back at it, and I still have like some old like training journals and all that kind of thing, and had all my workouts printed out on Excel sheets and stuff. I did a pretty good job for a 14-year-old kid.
Right.
But I just did a ton of training. I would train, you know, 3-4 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week, you know, throwing the shot put, sprinting, jumping. You know, I was always good at squatting and power cleans and stuff, and everyone likes to do what they're good at. Right. So I guess kind of fortunately, I never got caught up in, you know, just wanting to be like a bench and curl, you know, bro like Mark is. But
Hell yeah. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. So I just, and my training was always focused on performance. I was never really interested by bodybuilding, so I never did a lot of it, which mm-hmm. is a bit regrettable to me now. I wish I would have done a little bit more, or I wish I liked doing that training more so I could, you know, be a little more jacked and stuff. But yeah. But it was just performance-based training. I wanted to run as fast as I could, jump as high as I could, you know, throw the shot put as far as I could, and be as good a football player as I could. So since I was 14, I did that and just trained really, really hard.
And you weren't butting heads with strength coaches along the way who wanted you to do things their way, or?
Yeah, so in high school, we didn't have a strength coach or anything. You know, like, our football coach saw that I was working hard, and he kind of just let me do my thing.
Yeah.
So I went to Cal, Berkeley, on a track scholarship. So I had about a year and a half there where I was doing that, their program. Unfortunately, it didn't get very much stronger during that time. Transferred schools and then went back to having the same coach that I had in high school.
Okay.
So he let me control all my own training. He really just helped me with my technique in the ring, in the shot put, but everything else I controlled. And then since then, Josh Bryant had to help me with some of my powerlifting training, my second and third meets, particularly my bench and deadlift. Yeah, I bounce a lot of things off of Brandon now, off of Dr. Mike Isratel, Blaine Sumner, but for the most part, just kind of doing my thing. I've also spent most of my lifting career training by myself. Very, very few times with real training partners for too long a period of time. Maybe I'm just an asshole and no one likes to train with me. But
I work too hard. I wouldn't want to do it. Fuck it.
But, yeah, you know, people see Instagram videos or whatever when I'm in the, my little corner squat rack, you know,
right,
by myself in the corner of a CrossFit gym, squatting twice as much as anyone else in there. So just sort of, you know, try to be real cerebral and focused on the process of training. But I've always enjoyed the challenge of programming.
I think some people should. And I think everybody needs to understand, you know, what works for them and what they should be doing on a day-to-day basis in the gym. But some people suck and they kill themselves. And other people are afraid to do anything that isn't totally, you know, prescribed by somebody else.
Yeah. And that's something that I encourage people, you know, with at seminars and clinics all the time, is that you need to take ownership of what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you need to understand why you're doing it for you. You know, if your reasoning is, you know, I'm doing this exercise because Chad does it, or because, you know, Mark does it, or, you know, I saw it on Instagram, it constantly shocks me. I'll go down Instagram comments and see people, and they'll like tag their friend, like, oh, let's try this exercise today. I was like, is that how you guys make your program? You just go down and
take this person's exercise.
And I'm glad that they're enthusiastic about it, but they're not doing it because they understand, you know, that it's a weakness of theirs that's going to address. They're just doing it because they thought it looked cool.
Right.
And
which it probably does. Instagram's pretty cool.
Yeah. But, you know, the people really need to take ownership of what they're doing, understand, you know, why they're doing it for them. And Vasilei Alexeyev, who's, you know, probably the greatest super heavyweight weightlifter of all time, he had a great
killer fucking singlet, by the way.
Yes, yes.
You ever see that thing?
Yeah. I might try.
Mike just spit water all over himself.
I might try and
Dude,
pick one
fucking,
of those up for Australia.
Kill it.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, everyone wants to do my program, but you can't do my program because then it would be your program.
Right.
And that people need to understand why they're doing it for them and, you know, take accountability for their gain, you know, the success and failures of that program.
I know that a lot of people used to program off. When we had workout videos every week, people would program off of that.
They would
that.
Wait till we put something out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and see what we did.
I can't go to the gym until I see what they did. Like that
special snowflake training, like you said earlier. Yeah. That's a book right there, snowflake training.
Yeah.
You're snowflake all, concept?
All unique snowflakes, little snowflakes.
It's cute.
So Juggernaut is a training system. It's a clothing line. And then now it's a gym, right?
Yeah. So going back into having a physical gym location opening right now, more or less.
Ish. Yeah. Today?
Yeah, in Laguna Niguel, California. So down there in the OC.
$100 a month. Sounds worth it to me.
Yeah, and very, I'd like to think a pretty competent staff of myself, Brandon Lilly.
Oh, Bird Dog?
Brandon. Yeah, I don't know about that guy.
Dr. Quinn Hennock and, you know, everything that there is, you know, everything that Juggernaut does pretty much under one roof. So that's
cool.
Powerlifting, Olympic lifting, strongman, competitive CrossFit, recreational CrossFit, physical therapy, chiropractic, nutrition. It's all right there.
Fashion shows.
Definitely fashion shows.
When is there any dance floors or anything?
The world,
no music?
The world is the dance floor.
Oh, okay. The world is your dance floor.
Yeah.
When did the concept of kind of bringing all those sports together come about? Like you said, you kind of started in 2009. Even today, but when I kind of started powerlifting, maybe, I don't know when, 2010 or 11, bodybuilders hated powerlifters, powerlifters hated bodybuilders, and they all thought weightlifters were dumb. And then now, bodybuilders and powerlifters kind of get along. Weightlifters are just kind of doing their own thing still.
They're still in their own fucking world.
But everybody hates CrossFitters. But you, and Super Training tries to do it too, is just show that we're more similar than different. But Juggernaut, yeah, I mean, you sponsor and really expose all these top athletes. And all their training is the exact same, just different movements.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that the principles to the different sports are not different principles. It's just they're applied differently. And I think every sport has something that they can learn, you know, from the other sport. Powerlifters can learn about, you know, nutrition from bodybuilders. We can learn about, you know, increasing work capacity and that the benefits of that from CrossFitters. Same thing from weightlifters. Weightlifters, obviously, you know, they're training 9-10 sessions a week. Yeah, you know, great attention to detail in the technique. I think their mental approach to training is so much more focused. You know, you don't see many weightlifters, you know, headbutting the bar, you know, hitting ammonia cap before they're hitting the lift. They're just, you know, these volumes and volumes of work, and it's so technical. And yeah, you know, so everyone has things that they can learn from the other sports. And yeah, you know, I know that I don't know everything about all these sports and all these different aspects of training, like nutrition and mobility and all that. So I have, you know, my ego is not so big that I can say, all right, Dr. Quinn, I'm going to give you this platform to talk about mobility and movement, and Dr. Mike Isretel to talk about nutrition. You know, just kind of bring all these different experts together, and it's like a high tide raises all boats situation where we're all going to get better and benefit from each other.
What are you trying to do with Juggernaut? You know, you kind of have this team now. You got how many athletes are you working with?
I think 18 sponsored lifters.
Cool. Yeah, and what's kind of the goal?
Really putting me on the spot there.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
goal?
To eliminate
my goal 18? Is to fuck up everybody that's in my way.
Yes. You know, we want to keep doing what we're doing and just continually doing it better. And that's really just bringing valuable content to our, you know, readers, subscribers that's going to help them improve as a coach and athlete and allow them to reach their goals better. And at the same time, you know, through the creation of that content, being able to better support the athletes, you know, our team athletes, right, as they're either trying to go to the Olympics for weightlifting or the CrossFit Games or be the best powerlifters that they can be. You know, just to give them the resources to do that. And really for a lot of these lifters, to give them a platform to kind of build their own, you know, build their own brand.
Right.
And
help increase their following and things like that.
Yeah, so they can just better support themselves by doing what they love.
Right.
Yeah.
What are some things that you've learned? Have you thrown some things at some people that just kind of blew up in your face and you're like, fuck, that didn't work, and you had to kind of move, you know? You said you're not letting your ego get in the way. So has there been any situations like that?
So the most valuable thing I think I've learned about training in the last 5 years, really since I started Juggernaut, almost 6 years, has been this idea of breathing and bracing and how that's properly done. Maybe some mistakes that I made with that before where, you know, everyone hears the cue, like big air in your belly, push your abs out in your belt. And that's what I always did. And I think that led to a big part of me having these two herniated discs in summer 2013.
Yeah, Ed said he's never felt anything from that. He didn't never liked that.
Yeah. So, you know, huge thanks to Ryan Brown and Dr. Quinn Hennock from Dark Side Strength that, you know, as they helped me with my rehab process. I remember the first time Ryan talking to me about it, he's like, yeah, we're going to teach you how to breathe today. And I was like, what are you talking about? I know how to breathe.
Like, fuck you.
Yeah, I'm alive. I know how to breathe. And it seems like kind of this, like, hokey physical therapist thing, like, you know, like a corrective exercise and that stuff. It's not sexy. It's not cool. Mm-hmm. But it's had a profound effect on my performance as a lifter and, you know, just, like, general wellness. Yeah, you know, where I was always walking around with back pump and stuff and back.
It doesn't aching. Sound like you breathe very well to me. we'll take a 5-minute break so Chad can catch his breath.
And yeah, just where now I don't deal with back pain, and it's improved my movement, my mobility.
How long ago did you get hurt?
June 2013. So,
and then, like, what kind of weight could you move back then at that time when you were hurt?
Yeah, I remember the day I got hurt was deadlifting on a Wednesday afternoon, and then Thursday afternoon or Friday morning, we had to fly to Chicago to do a 2-day seminar out there. So when I got up from the plane, I think it took me about 30 seconds to go from sitting to fully standing, trying to do like a dip out of the chair.
Is that abnormal?
And so for those first couple of weeks, yeah, I could barely like hinge at the waist. And when I started back training the first, and I knew I wanted to take my time with it because my oldest brother's had some back surgeries, and I see, you know, how that really affects your life for the long term, where he had days where he couldn't pick up his daughters and stuff.
Shit. Yeah.
And he's had a spinal fusion surgery, but
God damn.
So I knew that I wanted to take time and really be thorough in my rehab. So when I got back to training, that training was breathing drills and bodyweight squats. 3 sessions a day, 7 days a week.
And was that hard?
Yeah. The breathing drills, when you do them right, man, besides like being a fat ass and getting really out of breath by doing it, like, it is the hardest ab work I've ever done. And so I started just with bodyweight stuff, you know, 3 times a day, every day for like 3 weeks, then went to goblet squats twice a day, you know, every day for another 3 weeks. And then by the time I finally started back actually lifting, like, I started with 135 front squats and 185 back squats for 5 sets of 10. I just front squat one day, back squat the next day, and just added, you know, 20 to 50 pounds a week up until I was back with like reasonable.
And now here you are squatting up over 900 pounds, right?
Yeah. So it was almost a year to the day that I did my first meet after the injury, which was meet at your place, June 2014. Squat 937 there, which was a 32-pound PR. And then went to Australia a couple months after and squat 959. So, like, you know, I came back way stronger than before the injury, just generally healthier, moving better.
Yeah, your progression has been unbelievable, but there's been some huge progression with some of the people you work with, too. You mentioned you work with a little pit bull guy, the 165er, and I know you're working with Jake Johns as well, big SC boy. What has their progression been like so far? I know you kind of just started working with Jake, but the other guy you've been working with for a while, right?
Yeah, Kevin Torres, the Pitbull Torres. Been fortunate enough to, he's from Irvine where I grew up. I actually started working with Kevin when he was in high school. He squatted 565 at 165 when he was 17 years old.
That's insane.
And
that might have been at our meet too.
No, that was at Power Station Pro-Am in Cincinnati. Oh,
nice. That's back in the day.
Yes. The classic SPF event. And
hell yeah.
It wasn't even in like a Days Inn ballroom or anywhere classy like that, though.
Oh, man.
They had it in a real live convention center. But
they blew it.
Yeah. But, yeah, so he played college football for a while and kind of bounced around and did some other things. But yeah, I'm definitely looking for a very big result from him at USPA Nationals in July, that he's going to take a real good run at the 165's total record, which just got broken.
He's gonna break it. Let's just say here, late breaking news.
You heard it first.
So yeah, he's
put him on the spot. Fuck it.
No, he talks about that he's gonna break it publicly all the time. So yeah, he just squatted 640 yesterday. So.
He benches like 400 too, right?
Yeah, he should be in the 420 kind of range at the meet.
That's crazy.
And yeah, he's just a little tank. I mean, great, you know, great build for powerlifting. He's jacked as shit.
Like, yeah.
But walks around about 180 pounds, only 5'3", And it has a very Cohen-esque build, except he has tiny midget hands instead of those huge
mitts.
Yeah.
Womp, womp.
And
who else have you worked with that made a lot of progress?
Yeah, I'm definitely most proud of is Marissa Inda.
She's a stud.
Yeah,
she's all bendy and shit.
Started working with her last year at right after IPF Worlds, Raw Worlds. She had kind of a disappointing performance there. Her best total at the time was 782, and this is in the 114s USAPL IPF. So, tested.
Toughest judging around,
2 hour weigh-in, super strict judging, and she's gone from 782 to 854. 70 pound increase, like, that doesn't sound like.
Well, she's already experienced, yeah.
Yeah, she's been lifting for 20 years, but you got to think, like, percentage wise.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah. 70 pounds on a 750 pound total, that'd be it's like me
over
putting,
20 pounds per lift. It ends up being a lot.
Yeah, that'd be like me putting 200 pounds on my total in a year. Right. And, looking for her to go total over 900 pounds here pretty soon, which, for a 111 pound girl, 111 pound woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, totaling over 900 and just a belt and knee sleeves without a deadlift bar with 2 hour weigh-in, super strict judging. Always very proud of the hard work that she does.
Do you take credit for her and Pitbull's jackedness? They're both two of the most jacked people running around.
Yeah, they were jacked long before they met me. But I've been fortunate, particularly right now to have a pretty good stable of athletes I'm coaching. Jake Johns, Kevin Torres, T. Papula, T.P. Hulk, another guy who's super jacked. They're obviously not getting that from me. They got better diet and advice than I give out.
That guy is jacked, though. T.P. is super jacked.
Yeah, he looks insane.
Yeah, he's ridiculous. And,
he must have won some bodybuilding shows. He looks amazing.
Yeah, he's kind of competed simultaneously in both.
Nigerian Nightmare.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
That's great. That's amazing.
With working with females, is there any difference other than their boobies? Now, is there any difference with working with females that are small and undersized? And is the training any different? I know like the movements end up looking quite a bit different from a girl as they do for a guy.
Yeah, the main difference in training the females is that in general they can tolerate higher total volumes at relatively higher percentages or relatively higher intensities than male lifters can.
So for dumb people, they're good at reps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
multiple reps, multiple sets.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about here, ladies and gentlemen. And sorry for the information. I apologize in the beginning.
And would hold true some for lighter weight men's lifters as well, that they can do higher volume, higher frequency.
So you have to squeeze more out of that rather than just banging your head against the wall doing singles kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's more what you're looking for with them.
Definitely. And I've been very fortunate with Marissa because she has a great bodybuilding and physique background, that she already has way more muscle than any other 114 class girl.
Right.
But most female lifters, just building more muscle is going to be even more important than it is for men's lifters. And the way you build muscle is reps.
Right. So. Well, and a lot of females struggle with the upper body strength. They struggle with the bench press. I know it's different for every girl, and some girls are awesome at benching, but in general, most girls kind of struggle with the bench. Usually they're doing double body weight squats and double body weight deadlifts, fairly easy, fairly close to when they – maybe just several months or a year after they get into training, but their bench press is usually like right around their own body weight or sometimes even less. What are some things they can do to – you mentioned reps to help build up some muscle. That's kind of obvious. And then what are some other things they could do to help increase their bench press?
Yeah, so the frequency of the bench press training, which is going to carry over into the total volume. Like female lifters.
This is for our three female listeners that listen to the show.
Two and a half, I think.
Female lifters are definitely going to be able to handle higher frequency bench training, whether that's three or up to four times a week. And then even doing little mini kind of workouts for upper back, whether that's doing 20 band pull aparts between every set of squats.
Right.
No one's going to overtrain doing band pull aparts.
Yeah, sneak it in there somewhere.
Yeah. And when you look at just one session, it's like, okay, she did 100 band pull aparts. That's really nothing. But you do that five times a week, for 4 weeks and month after month after month.
Right.
Like that adds up to tons and tons of volume. As you can add that, a little bit of muscle on top of a little bit of muscle, makes a huge difference.
Blows my mind that so many CrossFit girls can handstand walk like they're walking on their feet, And we always
Ashley Beaver.
Yeah, we always hear like, oh, they don't have the upper body strength. Well, it's body weight, but it's body weight for a crazy number of reps.
Yeah, it's really just really hard. I tried to do handstand push-ups one time. I was like, fuck it. Like, all these people are going nuts. Like, I'll bang out 10. Like, I'm not a huge bencher, but I'm not heavy. I did like 3, and I'm like, it's so hard.
Right.
And yeah, that kind of like mini workout idea, that's actually something I've encouraged a lot of CrossFitters on. We have one of our sponsor guys named Reed Worthington. And
that sounds like a fake name. It sounds like he should be a butler.
Yeah, was he from England?
Yeah.
Reed Worthington.
And Reed was struggling with handstand push-ups, so I just had him start doing, you know, in between every set of squats, or, you know, on a lower body day, go over and do, you know, 2 handstand push-ups, or every hour, because he owns his own gym and coaches, like every hour do 5 handstand push-ups.
Uh-huh.
And you know, that one set of 5 handstand push-ups for him is nothing. But when he's at the gym for 8 hours, now you did 40 extra in a day.
Right.
And that happens, you know, 3 or 4 times a week.
That's the way people get better at push-ups and pull-ups and stuff, too. Yeah. I mean, even kids, you know, they just around the house will bang out, you know, push-ups. Some of the people that are the best in the world at push-ups, they started doing, you know, 50 push-ups a day and then 100 and so on. They just bang them out whenever they can during a commercial of TV or whatever.
Yeah, I think that kind of almost micro, you know, micro workouts. But
it's not going to make you sore.
Yeah, with really, really high frequency, it adds up over time.
I think we'd eliminate a lot of ADHD problems in school if we had them take a break every, you know.
And bang out some handstand
push-ups. Yeah, every 50 minutes, do some handstand push-ups or something.
Yeah.
What about the hot trend of squatting every day? Thoughts?
Oh, you know, it can work great. It's not for beginners, and it's not for, I think, heavier weight lifters, just because the load is going to be too high. I can't squat. Yeah, I'm going to break down a lot faster.
Even a daily max would be 800 for you every day, and it would be 375 to 450 for me.
Yeah, and so that's something to consider. And it can certainly it could have its place in, you know, intermediate and advanced training for, you know, almost anyone besides the, you know, top heaviest lifters in the higher weight classes. But as a part of the training, not as an all the time thing, you know, a 1 month like that, 2 months like that, 3 months like that, you know, a concentrated loading block, if we want to get, you know, with fancy words, talk about it can definitely have merit. I talked with Max Aida at length about his experience.
Yeah. And Max has the best stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
And Max is one of the, you know, the few people in the whole world who has a real perspective on the Bulgarian method.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, he lived it.
Yeah. And his
squatting so much he couldn't get upstairs. Him and his buddies would just not even bother to go upstairs to their bedrooms. They just sleep on the floor in their living room.
Yeah, and listening
like,
to him
that. Fuck stairs.
Tell those stories is like, I mean, crazy. Just his dedication to it, because I would have given up. Like there's no way that I don't care about squats enough to do that. You know, month after month, multiple times per day, and it's certainly a great test of your, you know, mental fortitude. But, you know, as far as a real viable training strategy, it has application, but it's limited to, you know, 1 to 3 month blocks here and there.
Do you think for powerlifting you'll start to take away from your other lifts?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's gonna when the
volume show up somewhere.
Yeah, and that goes for any kind of real high volume, high frequency program, Sheko, you know, or a Smolov type of program, Russian squat cycle, that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
it's designed to, you know, give the squat a huge boost. And the deadlift's going to take a hit during that time. And, you know, if you do a Smolov Junior or something, your squat goes up 50 pounds and your deadlift goes down 10, mm-hmm. Well, the squat's going to come back down after that when you're not doing it as frequently.
Yeah.
But if you still, you know, end up with a, you know, net like plus 30 pounds in the squat, that could be a good thing. But you're not going to do Smolov and then do it again and then do it again and then do it again. It has a limited application.
Yeah.
I think.
What's your frequency look like with masturbation? 17 times a day.
Oh, are we in a concentrated loading block?
Loading block. Deload,
so to speak.
You know, you're talking a lot about.
You're so gross.
Well, I want to know. This is important. You know, we're talking a lot about frequency. What's commonly recommended by you for squat, bench, and deadlift? I know it's very specific, but just kind of in general.
Yes. So that question, you know, how many times a week should I squat, is one of the most common.
I don't fucking know.
Because. Yeah, it really does. It deals with the principles, and I could say one time a week, and I could say 6 times a week, and anything in between. You know, it could be right for some people at different times of the year. So, what I would say is the farther away you are from a meet, the more frequently you're going to squat. And the closer you are to a meet, the less frequently you're going to squat. Because it's all, you know, just a relationship of frequency and volume versus intensity. And as you get closer to the meet, the intensity has to increase. As intensity increases, you have to have a way to build in more recovery to your training. And if I only squat once every 7 days instead of once every 3 days, well, I got four extra days to recover, three extra days to recover.
Right.
So that's sort of how I do it. Like when I have
spreading out the squat, like I think you said you do three times a week right now. You're in the off season.
Yeah.
Spreading it out, that allows you to kind of get all three avenues of strength. I guess you can do some volume work, you can do some technique work, and you can even do some just heavy squats, right? You kind of mix it up a lot. Is that why it's spread out?
Yeah, well, I just spread it out to allow for like a higher weekly volume.
I got you.
Yeah, because
if you add it up at the end of the week, it'd be twice as great as if you did it one time or something like that.
Yeah, like unless you have someone who just has a great capacity to have one balls out crazy training session.
Right.
Chances are that someone who squats three times a week does more total squats than someone who does one time a week.
Right.
And it just gives you more frequent practice of the lifts. And I think that's something a lot of powerlifters...
Come on, man. We talking about practice?
Something that a lot of powerlifters have, not as much right now, but in the past couple of years, kind of lost sight of the idea that the squat, bench, and deadlift done with competition equipment, you know, whatever that may be, to competition standard, is your sport practice. And you'd never have a time of the year, you know, where a football player or a basketball player is like, I'm not going to play football or basketball at all, you know,
right?
Or I'm just going to play rugby at this time of the year. Like, some, yeah, it's similar.
Throwing a shot put, it's all about practice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, that's the most specific exercise that they can do, so it's going to have the highest carryover to their sport performance. So that's something that's, you know, always present in my training is the squat, bench, and deadlift to competition standard. Farther away from the meet, I mean, adding more variation to that, but the degree of variation I think is something that a lot of people get confused about. So if the most specific thing is the competition lift, so for me, belt, knee wraps, you know, if we want to get really technical, squat bar, you know, competition plates for one rep, any deviation from that is some variation. Two reps is a variation, three reps, change a bar position, change a stance width, change the tempo of the lifts, pauses at different places. Those are all lifting. Those are all variations, and they're going to avoid, you know, allow the athlete to avoid accommodating to what they're doing. You know, and that's what so many people get like caught up in the idea. If I don't change exercise every week or every 2 weeks, then I'm going to accommodate, and my gains are going to plateau. You
know, with a Z,
with two Z's.
Oh wow! Yeah. Oh, you took it to the next level right there.
That's only if you're doing well, though. Yeah. But if you're doing shitty, it's only one Z, I think.
Yeah. And then really shitty is an S.
But might as well quit.
If somebody's really struggling in a, let's just say, a bench press or deadlift, do you sometimes recommend that they do it more often?
The bench press, yes.
The deadlift, probably not, but why?
Yeah, deadlift is just so much more taxing to the nervous system that it's kind of its own beast out of the three lifts. It has the most unique programming considerations. And this is... If someone's really naturally built well to deadlift, you know, they're very like thin, long build, right, they can probably tolerate deadlifting more frequently than someone who's stockier.
Right. And technique plays into it a lot. Mike and I talk about that a lot, where if you have a good foundation, you got good form, you could probably do the lift more often.
Yeah, because it's just making it more efficient, so it's less stressful to your body.
Yeah, I use the example of Ed Cohn and Dan Green all the time, because people are like, oh, well, I'm kind of doing the Dan Green thing where he does like 20 variations of the deadlift
like
in one day.
Like, you Dan Green's legs?
I was like, yeah, that guy's back is 20 times bigger than all of ours. His thighs are bigger than all of ours, and his bar path and form on the sumo is just fucking perfect. Like, you're not going to be able to do that. Sorry, buddy. You're going to injure your back.
Yeah. That's something that I see more and more lifters getting caught up in, you know, because powerlifting is growing and it's becoming more popular, and that's great, and, you know, you guys are probably a big reason why that sort of thing is happening. But now you get all these people, and they've been watching their YouTube videos or whatever, and they want to lift the same way that Dan lifts, or the same way that, you know, Mike Tashier. That a lot of particularly people I think who do DUP periodization, daily undulating periodization, they're not ready to squat, you know, heavy, like hard training sessions three or four times a week, or bench hard four or five times a week,
right,
or deadlift hard two or three times a week, because their technique is not efficient enough. And the more intensely they load those movement patterns, the quicker they're going to ingrain them, and they're not ingraining the right thing, and it's going to lead to injury for a lot of young lifters. I see all the, you know, 21, 22, 23-year-old lifters who come in without much training history, and they're getting too advanced too quick, and particularly, like, too high of intensity too quickly before they really learn how to do it right.
Everybody wants everything now.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks they're going to be special. They're afraid that they're going to miss their opportunity to be a superstar in a sport that most people don't give a shit about.
That's true. Do you, with newer lifters, do you, you know, do you really have a, you know, hard on for the execution of it? You want to see that they're getting the lift right. Do you try to pull them back from going heavy and just have them work on the you know, mainly the frequency and the technique of it?
Yeah, the submaximal training and high frequency training is going to be great for the newer lifter, because it's, like I said, it's more opportunity to practice the lifts, and yeah, the, like I said, the more intensely you load a movement, the quicker you're going to ingrain that movement pattern. So you don't want to be maxing out all the time with a with a new lifter, because chances are their technique's going to break down and that's going to get ingrained.
How would you kind of pick their lifts if you were watching them, if you were physically watching them lift? Would you like to take them to a point like where they're almost about to break down, or you just like to not even have them anywhere near that?
Well, yeah, you at some point need to identify where that breaking point is.
Gotcha.
And then treat that as, like, you know, whether you do percentage-based training, RPE, whatever, you know, if you have someone whose technique looks great, you know, up to 300 pounds and then 315 in the squat, it starts to fall apart. Well, that person needs to do a lot of practice, you know, a lot of training in the range where their technique looks good, you know, 260 to 300 pound range, and do volumes and volumes of work there. And then now they can start to look good. You know, now they go up to 320, and until 320, it looks good, or 330, it looks good before it breaks down. So now they start doing a lot of work in 280 to 320 range,
right?
Volumes and volumes of work there. But the whole idea, you know, that people think that their technique should, or it's acceptable for it to break down on a max lift, is totally flawed thinking, in my opinion, because good technique is good because it allows you to express your strength the best.
Right.
So if you have a technical breakdown, your knee came in, you know, your butt shot up early, whatever it is, but you made a max lift, like, don't go on there and say, oh, it's okay, you know, everyone's technique breaks down on one rep max. Right. That wasn't a real max if your technique broke down, because good technique is what's going to allow you to express your strength the most efficiently.
Right. Yeah, and you wouldn't want your technique to break down when you're shooting a three-pointer in the fourth quarter either, right?
Yeah.
You want to be able to express that technique at any time, any place.
Yeah. So, you know, putting all the care possible into making, let's say, treat your max like 135 or treat 135 like your max like 135. Practice great technique on every single rep, all right? And then approach the maxes.
He's talking to you, Mike.
I don't know. I'm listening.
And approach the maxes
preach to.
With the same confidence that you approached all the warm-up sets.
Mike cries kind of when people talk to him like this.
And you see it the most, you know, the most commonly in the squat. Someone looks great in all these warm-up sets, and they get to that, you know, to their top set, and as soon as they unrack it, that look of, oh, shit, this is heavy.
You see it right in their face.
Yeah, it comes over their face, and instead of descending with confidence and, you know, getting some rebound out of the hole, now it's...
I think that's, like, pretty much always my face. Like, oh, shit, this is not going to go so good.
Now they're going slow and shaky on the way down because they had no confidence about it. So it's not an easy thing
when
to be confident.
When they cut it high.
How have you done that with your own training? Because it's, you know, especially with the interwebs nowadays and all these big lifts going down all the time on YouTube, it's hard not to get, like, caught up in it. So how have you done that with your training? Do you have to just tell yourself, this is the way to get better, and I got to fucking stick to it?
Pretty much, yeah, just trying to be disciplined within my plan. I take a lot of pride in setting my training up in the way that's going to peak me the best. You know, so I'm the absolute strongest I can be on the one day that matters. And there are a lot of guys who are better gym lifters than me, and they have more YouTube followers, and they lift heavier weights in the gym, but I lift a heavier weight when it actually matters.
Right.
And if you want to be a competitive powerlifter, only the meat matters. Like, my best lifts in the gym are 875 in the squat.
Pussy.
875 in the squat, 525 in the bench, 804 in the deadlift.
Terrible.
Compared to
numbers.
To 959, 567, 810. And that's held true throughout
10%
my...
10% difference or so. I think you wrote about it before, 12%, something like that.
Yeah, it's a pretty hot topic too, I think.
Yeah, the squat one is particularly high, but the total ends up being about 7.5% carryover. And that holds true for
kind of
my entire career. And So because I'm doing more submaximal load, I get to practice great technique all the time.
How do you have the confidence to hit those weights in the meet when you haven't, like, because most of the time you probably haven't touched them in training, right?
Yeah, usually the only time I've touched the squat weight would be in like a walkout and hold situation. Okay. Where I just
and is that with like your opener, or would that be like your second attempt?
I'll do the walkout and hold with what I want to squat at the meet. So I think when I squat 937,
so it'd be your third attempt.
Yeah, except I've lately been squatting like take what I want on the second.
Right.
Because I seem to like to miss my second and come back and make it on the third. Like before I squatted 937 at your meet, I did a 945 walkout and hold. I think I did.
How long do you hold that for? 10 seconds?
Yeah, 10, 15 seconds.
Okay.
And I also try and do, you know, I train by myself and I train in a very calm type of environment. Like if whatever.
Yeah, Jake Johnson, like he can't do it.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not going to lift with him.
Yeah, yeah. Big boy was like, dude, it is so hard. It's like, it's not the training. It's that he's like, there's no music. It's like you could hear a fucking cricket fart in there.
And because you know, I'm just trying to focus on my technique, and I don't want to have adrenaline in training. I want to save that all for the meet. And
what about like a stimulant or anything? You have caffeine or anything going into training session, or
if
you need it, you'll take it
as rarely as possible.
Right,
that's so sad. I feel bad for you.
So that's intentional, right?
Very intentional. Yeah. Even before, I think before November 2013, I had never had a cup of coffee in my whole life.
Oh,
but I would go to a meet and have like three extra strength 5-hour energies, and imagine how like profound that effect is.
Yeah, you know?
And so even now, like even though I drink coffee and stuff now, I'll still try and wean off of it like the last 2 weeks before a meet, so I can kind of, you know, desensitize myself.
Yeah. Kind of your body reacts to it.
Harness its power.
Yes. Kind of goes back to something Cone said too about there being like only so many in the bank, only so many max lifts over whatever, you know, percentage in the bank, and you have to sort of manage those over the course of a career.
Cone talked about like never maxing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like every once in a while in a meet, you would get to that point because your third attempt is there and you'd go for it. But he basically kind of said, I don't know if it's true, but he basically said he's never missed a lift in the gym.
Yeah. And I think, you know,
that's a good principle, whether it's true or not. It's a good principle to try to fall within, you know?
Yeah. And I definitely preach that same thing. You know, you don't miss lifts, don't make you stronger. Made lifts do. And yeah, I miss lifts. And
that's opposite of like some of the information that came from Westside Barbell with the max effort. You know, not to get controversial, but with the max effort method, Louis would kind of preach like it doesn't fucking matter. Go as heavy as you can. As long as you have two or three heavy lifts in there, it's fine.
Well, he talks about like learning the grind.
Right.
Yeah, I definitely think there's value in that. Like I know what 100% effort, you know, 10 RPE lift feels like.
Right.
I know that I can grind through that and I'm not going to die. My body's not going to break apart. So I don't need to practice that feeling all the time. If someone doesn't know what that feels like, they need to find out.
Right.
But it's not a every
someone newer might need
thing.
To do it once a month or something on a particular lift. Something
well, I think
like that, right?
It's kind of like a fight or flight thing.
Yeah.
Like you give it something in a squat per se. You fucking give into that bar, doesn't move, and then some people like literally just fall. You see them just fall, and then like spotters have to go, whatever. But then
the legs give out.
Know how to grind per se in their head. They're like, fuck that, you know. And at least you keep pushing.
And there's something to be said with that too. As you get stronger and stronger, the training is more stressful. You know, putting 900 pounds on my back is more stressful than someone else putting 300 pounds on their back, just because it's three times as much weight.
Right.
And all that stuff, getting really fired up in the gym, that all has to be accounted for because everything we do is a stress.
It takes energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so why, you know, I don't want to get fired up in the gym if I don't need to, because it's adding unnecessary stress to the process.
Adrenal fatigue.
If that's bleeding over into the next workout? Like maybe it doesn't affect you right there. But for you, your frequency is high. The next day, you got to come in and probably bench or deadlift or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Training doesn't happen in a vacuum. So if I have, you know, this session affects next
session. My training does because it sucks so bad. Get it? Get it?
Affects next session, and it all has to be accounted for. So I try and, you know, as much as possible, and the closer the meet gets, like just stay within my planned weights, because I write programs for people with percentages, but I don't. My own programs, I say I want to do this at the meet. So I need to do this in week 12, I need to do this in week 11, so on and so forth, just working backwards from there. And as the meet gets closer and closer, I just want to stay within that plan. Even if I have a day where I feel great and maybe I could have gone 20 or 30 pounds over, I know if I do that on Monday's squat, you know, maybe Wednesday's bench isn't going to go quite as well. So real quick, though, with the feel on the weights, and kind of finish that, the a 10% overload is really all I advocate for people. So, yeah, on the squat, I usually feel, you know, because I'm squatting about 10% more in a meet than in training, I'll feel that weight just in a walkout and hold.
Yeah.
Bench, I think before my last bench where I benched 567 in the meet, I want to say I did 565 in the slingshot.
There you go.
The Mark Bell slingshot.
plug, buy one.
About 10 days out from the meet, but that was as heavy as I had gone. And 525 raw, 565 in the slingshot. And
slingshot doesn't really feel like anything when you have a really heavy weight on there.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's fucking going to help you at all. You're like, is this thing going to even help me?
And that's something with training not happening in the vacuum. I think people get too caught up in the overload. And the overload principle is an important part of training. But see these guys trying to put, you know, 25, 50% more than their max on. It's like, what's that really doing for you? Like, it's nervous system stimulation.
Yeah, it's not about loading up as much as you can bear. Yeah.
I think when people come here and they see how we utilize the slingshot here, they're usually shocked because we actually go back down in weight a lot of times when we throw the slingshot on. It's just to get more work in.
Take 90% for 10 rather than 5.
Something. Sometimes it's close grip or it's just some sort of variation of the lift.
On that same note, why would you do a slingshot like a full range of motion, super maximal training, but only walk out squat?
Because 550 pounds isn't as stressful as 1,000 pounds.
Yeah, so instead of doing like maybe a reverse band or something like that,
yeah.
What about the deadlift, reverse band, block pull, something to overload a little bit near a meet?
I've used reverse band deadlifts before with some success. As my deadlift, I feel like I'm a much better deadlifter the last year or so, really the last like 9 months.
Must be the Sperry's.
Definitely the Sperry's. And
it's those tight pants he's wearing all the time.
The
walking around in spandex. That weighs 370 pounds.
They'll be on tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
You might need to wear like two pairs to keep everything tucked down.
To compress everything.
Yeah. Just tuck it up in the waistband.
Yep.
And, but
I threw them off.
Yeah. But I haven't been doing overload anymore for my deadlift. I'm actually worse at block pulls than from the floor.
You'll do them for work, but you won't do them for an overload.
Yeah. The deadlift, I haven't been doing any overload.
What about speed training? You mentioned a little bit earlier as a variation, some tempo. There's some people think you have to train fast to become fast. What are some of your thoughts on the different speeds that you can train at and what they do for you?
Yeah, I'm trying to make every rep speed work. I have the intent to move the bar with maximal velocity all the time. I'm someone who has an explosive sport background, so I'm fast. And
but also within reason too, like with 225 on a deadlift, you're not trying to like murder it, and you're not trying to break, like you're not trying to kill yourself with it, but you're trying to pick it up with some velocity.
That's some Dr. Hatfield type cat theory. Yeah.
And I think the merit to a speed work, and even though I'd say that I have like a speed day in my program, it could really just be phrased as a light day as well. Yeah, it's just
no reason to overcomplicate it.
Yeah. And I think for more intermediate, beginner and intermediate lifters, who are obviously the overwhelming majority of lifters out there, that those days aren't going to have – it's not going to be quite as necessary for them. That they're going to be able to tolerate more work in the higher range.
So for a newer person, it's kind of interesting. For a newer person, the way to get more explosive faster might just simply be to lift a little bit heavy.
Yeah, to get stronger.
To flat out just get stronger and not necessarily really worry about how fast you're lifting, because they're not going to be able to flex as hard, recruit as many motor units or however technical you want to get with
it. Yeah, I want to clarify real quick. When I'm talking about beginner intermediate doing more in that higher range, it's still, they're going to be maybe more in the 75 to 90% range, where that 60 to 75% that I do some work in isn't going to have much benefit for them because it's just too light.
You can't deadlift 750 every single week for the rest of your life.
I mean, part of that has to do with like force production. You can put a shit ton of force into 500 pounds, whereas somebody who's a beginner might not be able to put enough force for them to get better into like 250 pounds, something like that, right?
Yeah. And because each training session for them is not as big a stimulus, it's not as stressful, it won't warrant like a light session.
I got you.
One of every three of my squat sessions, I need that to be more in the 500 to 600 range, just because all the 700 and 800 stuff is very stressful. But them dropping down into the 225 range, it's not as necessary when most of their sessions are, somewhere in the 300s.
What does, slower lifting do for someone, like some sort of tempo type squat or even a pause squat?
Yeah, so slower in the eccentric part of the lift. Yeah, you know, eccentric is where a lot of the muscle damage is being caused, so it could help them build a lot more muscle, could help them build a lot more confidence and stability under the weight.
Can also kind of get more out of less weight. Like, you know, again, like just with speed work, it's a lighter day. So if you wanted to have a lighter day, you can just simply, you know, go 4 seconds on the way down, pause at the bottom, and that'll reduce the amount of fucking weight you can move, right? Yeah.
But I'm always going to advocate being as explosive as possible in the concentric portion of the lift.
Gotcha.
But as far as, you know, pause work, the simplest way to get stronger at a given weak point is to spend more time in that weak point. And pause work inherently is going to force you to do that. So Mike Tashir, is really the one who kind of opened my thinking up about pause
work. I thought you were going to say sphincter. You were close to saying sphincter, weren't you? You had to correct yourself. I saw that. Thanks, Mike. Mike T.
He was very polite about it, though.
He always is.
And most people think, all right, pause bench, that's just on your chest. Or pause squat, that's only in the hole. Pause deadlift, a lot of people have not, I don't think, really thought about that.
Yeah, hurts.
But, yeah, they didn't want to think about it. But, the pause can, you don't have to do it off the chest or at the bottom in the squat. Like, you can do it anywhere. So if I have, I have a sticking point in the squat, about 2 inches above parallel, 3 inches above parallel. So now I rebound out of the hole.
That
pause,
is so much harder.
Yeah, pause on the way back up. And, that's a very, very specific way to address that weak
point. What kind of weight can you move that way?
My best squat, like, that I've actually done was 750 like that. Oh, but it was not a maximal thing.
Yeah.
I do a lot. My light day, I do a lot more pause work there.
Is it used like, is it percentage-based or you're just kind of going off of?
Yeah, I could probably retroactively look at it and tell you the percentages.
Gotcha. You're just kind of going.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of, percentages are great. RPE is great. Like, intuitive training is going to be what really most of the top lifters are doing.
Right.
But there's no way, to teach someone how to train intuitively.
Yeah, you can't be intuitive for me.
Yeah.
For yourself, how do you do that? Like what weight do you get? Let's just use a squat for an example. What weight do you get to start to make decisions? You know, like you get to like 7 plates and you're like, okay, it's not there today or it is there today. Like, what weight do you get to and then start making decisions on how you're going to do it? Is it planned out beforehand?
Yeah, I pick all the weights beforehand. Like, I could, if my next meet is in November in Australia, I could tell you my plan every day right now.
It's in the
phone. And, I might make some small changes within the day, particularly in like the first microcycle, so the first month of training.
If you're sick or didn't get sleep or something happens.
Yeah. But for the most part, I know that those weights I'll be able to make.
Right.
So that's almost a bit more of a daily minimum, but I also try, as I get closer and closer to the meet, not to go over that very much because I know that's going to affect the next sessions. So
you try to stay within those ranges because you know that's what's going to be best for you. Yeah. I think that's the hardest thing to do as a lifter. You know, you get excited and you're like, fuck, man, it feels great. Like, I want to go for it. And then even on the days when it doesn't feel great, you still want to try to do something that's just not there sometimes.
Yeah. And I think every time that you have a day that feels great, and Brandon always says you got to cook while the pan is hot. Mm-hmm. And when you do that and you go off the plan, above the plan, with every high, there's a low's coming too.
Yeah.
And
no free lunch.
Yeah. So, that's going to create like this type of training more. For those people who are just listening, I'm making an up and down motion with my finger, and where I'd rather just have like, a little bit more steady type of progress.
Right. And if your training is correct, the days shouldn't be so sporadic anyway.
Correct.
God damn, he's got it all figured out.
That's why my head's so big.
It's very cone-like too, since we just had him here, I don't know if I would be thinking that way if he had not just been here, but that, pretty much always knowing what he was going to do, planning it out in advance, not deviating from the plan.
Yeah, I listened to that one maybe 2 weekends ago when I was driving to seminar, and pretty much all I was thinking was, I'm just going to say all the stuff Ed said so I sound smart and cool.
Yeah, I'm just going to fucking copy.
Well, it works. It worked.
Yeah, it worked pretty well.
What are some common mistakes that you see, powerlifters making that you'd like to see people change or think about more?
I think two real traps that people fall into from a programming standpoint is either too much intensity or too much volume. Guys who want to max out every single week.
What is, like, just in short, what is intensity and volume? What are we talking about here?
So intensity is, you know, how heavy the weight is compared to your one rep max. Gotcha. It's not like how tough a face you make.
Right.
Before
yeah,
you
and
lift.
What music you play. Yeah. Death metal.
And then the volume is, you know, the total amount of work, your tonnage.
Right. And it's mainly just referring to the working sets usually, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so the too much intensity crew, you know, they want to max out every single week and have really cool looking Instagram and YouTube videos.
Hey. He's talking to me again.
Yeah, don't cry this time.
And it, whether it's, you know, always doing really heavy, like 1 to 3 rep maxes, or it's, you know, always max reps, they're going to end up training above their maximum recoverable volume. All right.
Gotcha.
Or the people who are, if the guys who are doing the always like max rep sets, or if it's always 1 to 3 rep maxes, they're never going to have a time in their training where they do enough volume, enough practice to improve their technique, you know, and to build the necessary muscle to really be a great lifter. And then the too much volume side of things, they're taking it almost like a badge of honor. Like, look at how much work I did.
Right.
And volume's great. Volume's important. Volume's probably the best way to get stronger. But when you're 2 weeks out from a meet and you...
You don't really need 5 sets of 5.
Yeah. And I see even really good lifters posting about doing the really, really high volume super close to a meet. And I was like, you guys are kind of missing the boat here on the relationship of like fitness fatigue relationship. Mm. Yeah, their fatigue is just going to be too high that it's not going to be able to get reduced in time to the meet to peak properly.
Right. So a lot of your training seems to be based on like not just preparing for like what's coming up in the next like few weeks, but even what's coming up in the next several months.
Yeah. So that's,
and I don't think most people really give much thought to that, or maybe they just never learned it, so that's why they're not thinking about it much.
Yeah, this is something that Dr. Mike goes into length in the book, The Scientific Principles of Strength Training, is the idea of phase potentiation.
Juggernaut.com? Can you buy it off of there? Where's the website?
JTSstrength.com.
There you go.
And we use a fancy word for it so we can impress people and sound smart, called phase potentiation. But all phase potentiation really means...
I love gimmicks. I'm all into it.
is using one training cycle to increase the potential of the next training cycle. So that's really using, you know, for the powerlifter, it's going to be using an off-season type of period or a preparatory period, whatever you want to call it, to build more muscle and more work capacity so that you can do, you know, more high-quality, high-intensity work as you get closer and closer to the meet.
Right. So basically you're just kind of always doing opposing things to bring up, like, kind of an area that you might be weak in.
Exactly. Like I said, we like to use fancy words, but it boils down to pretty simple.
Yeah, you're like, okay, well, I was efficient at hitting some one rep maxes in a meet, but now I'm fat and I'm out of shape, and I need to go back the other way.
Exactly.
I need to do shit that's hard, challenging. I need to do sets of 10, sets of 12 for a little while.
Or time to rest.
Build the muscle back up. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to go about doing it. How do you go about getting in better shape?
Yeah, so
that physique. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just winked at him for those of you not watching my camera.
Yeah.
Making them blush.
So the idea of, getting in better shape, for powerlifting. So specific work capacity towards powerlifting. I do that through a lot of timed rest periods. I'll do, you know, a lot of cross fat, like EMOMs in the squat, or 1 minute rest periods, 90 second rest periods, and just getting the stopwatch out and making sure I stay consistent there, you know, where I could be in the gym for 3 hours and taking 5 minute breaks, but I don't need those. So just trying to do more work on controlled rest. Now,
10-second rest periods on those deadlifts, huh?
Yeah.
God damn.
And
it's that was hard.
Yeah.
I did that with Jake. That was brutal. I was using like 365. I was crying.
Yeah. And it sucks at first. And Josh Bryant was the guy who really opened my eyes to that.
Yeah, Josh is the worst.
Yeah.
He kills people.
Yeah.
God damn.
I remember having to do 10. So going up to a heavy set of 3 deadlifts, it was like 665 for 3. And then went down to 505 for 10 sets of 4 with 1 minute rest between each set.
Oh, my God.
And it was horrible. But the first time I went through a program like that, I couldn't do it. You know, I had to take longer rest periods.
Right.
I'd just take as short as I could. But then the next time it was easier.
Get
and now.
Better.
Yeah. And now I'll do like 12 triples at 550 in the squat every minute on the minute.
Oh, yeah.
And have a very good specific work capacity for that. I want to make sure to make that distinction. You know, the general work capacity or GPP.
Oh, you're not going to run a marathon.
Yeah. Like GPP is great and it will raise your special work capacity. So if I'm a powerlifter, my special work capacity is how much bench squat and deadlift can I do? you know, and dragging a sled or rowing or riding a bike, like that's going to raise my general work capacity. And if I'm in really bad shape, that'll improve how much squat, bench, and deadlift I can do. But you know what really improve how much squat, bench, and deadlift I could do? Doing more squatting, bench pressing, and deadlifting.
Right, and the sled could be great for burning calories or trying to get into a different weight class or something like that, or if your hamstrings suck, or you know, there could be a certain application to it. But that makes a lot of sense, just using the squat, bench, and deadlift.
Yeah, and you know, small variations to that. And like when I talked about, you know, variation is any change from the competitive movement. So two reps is variation, three reps. So sets of 10 in the squat are, you know, relatively fairly general compared to one rep in the squat.
Right.
And doing a bunch of sets of 10, it's going to get you in good shape to squat.
Basically, you have to find a lot of different things to try to get better at, because you can't always just increase your strength.
Yeah.
You got to find different avenues to pull from, right?
Yeah, I think it's important to really make sure you're manipulating all three factors of the program, the frequency, volume, and intensity. And then the rest periods.
Mike, you're failing to do all this.
I'm taking notes over here.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And then the rest periods is kind of the fourth bonus one that I think a lot of people overlook, but it's a great tool to challenge
CrossFit.
Yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you can learn from everyone. That's what we learn from the CrossFitters.
If you were working with somebody and they whip through that 505 for, 10 sets of four?
Yeah.
With how much rest is say?
1 minute rest periods.
Yeah, if somebody whipped through it, you'd be like, okay, that dude pulls 800 pounds.
Yeah. Kind of cross it off the lift. Yeah.
I mean, it would be like highly unlikely that guy only pulls 600, right? I mean.
Yeah, and the only time that kind of situation would arise is where someone's great at work capacity is if that's all they do, and that would be like the too much volume crew that I was talking about. They're just pushing volume, volume, volume. So they get great at sub-maximal lifting, you know, imparting like less than maximal force into the bar, and they can maybe do really high volumes of work, but they would show like a very low carryover from, you know, they'd have like a really high five rep max in comparison to their one rep max because they're great at 80-85% effort. Right. So there's a time where that's really important, and then as you get closer and closer to the meet, more and more specific training, which is going to be lower, you know, reps per set. It's more singles, doubles, and triples when I'm, you know, a month or 6 weeks out.
What has led you to this world-class strength? Is it something from your childhood, just always being involved in sports? You got good parents, you got shitty parents. Like, what happened? When did it happen? And, you know, kind of what led to you kicking so much ass?
I've just always been interested by being big and strong. And training has always interested me. Maybe I watched, like, Rocky IV montage too many times.
Oh, man.
But as far as, like, genetics, I know I have, like, some great genetic gifts. And
your kneecaps are fucking fat. Yeah.
But I'm actually adopted, so I just met my birth mom for the first time.
Wow.
2 summers ago. But and she
what was
not,
that like?
It was
weird.
She squats 700. That's weird.
She was like she's kind of a small, petite, kind of regular lady. It was cool. It was cool to get to meet her. I have two biological brothers who I met as well.
Cool.
And they were very.
They live in California?
Birth mom lives in Alaska.
Oh,
now.
Shit.
And yeah, where many people think that my real biological father, Bill Casper, also lives. But I didn't think it was a coincidence, but she denied it. I asked her point blank if it was Bill Casper. And
you're hoping.
Yeah,
he might have used another name.
I know I have some good genetic gifts, and that's going to play
a role. A good support system?
Yeah. So I got adopted when I was born by an incredible family who always, you know, provided a lot of opportunity for me and supported me with everything.
Cool.
My mom could tell you that the first time I was going to play, you know, peewee football, I was taking like those car bungee cords and like bungee cording myself to trees in the backyard and doing like sprints against these car bungee cords.
Yeah.
I was like 8 years old. And this was not having some like overbearing Marv Marinovich dad, like, oh, you got to do this to be good. Like I did that cause I wanted to, cause
it was fun for you.
Yeah.
And, stimulated.
So it kind of just started there. And then once I got into high school and really started lifting, of course, you know, I was not like a great football player as a freshman or like this big, strong guy. I was a decent weight room guy, but I saw very quickly that the harder I work at this, the better I'm going to be at that.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I could control, you know, it doesn't take any special talent to work hard.
Right.
Like I was not going to fail because someone outworked me on it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it just kind of kept developing from there.
Is that something you saw from other people, or you just got better, and you're like, I just need to continue to keep going down this path and get better?
For the most part, it's always been a very intrinsically motivated thing. Like, yeah, my parents came and watched my events, and you know, if I wanted to get some special coaching in something, they helped me, you know, seek that out, and obviously, you know, they paid for it. But like I said, I controlled my own program. I trained by myself. I trained by myself when I was 15 years old. Maybe someone else on the team would come and train with me for, you know, a couple weeks or a couple months, and then they would kind of fall by the wayside. And I'm talking like Christmas Day when I'm 15 or 16 years old. If that's a Wednesday and I'm supposed to train on Wednesday, I was going to train. You know, Christmas break, summer break, it didn't matter. Like, I just loved training. I loved the challenge of it, and I loved the tangible results of, I was able to lift this much weight, now I can lift this much, or I could run this fast, and now I can run that fast because of this work that I did.
Yeah, you put in work and you got better.
Novel idea.
Yeah. When did you find out that you were adopted?
I kind of always known. I don't.
You got Asian parents.
I don't remember a time, like the time where they sat me down and told me. I do remember that
they may have spoke of it like a lot or something when you were a kid, preparing you for it or something like that.
Yeah, I remember having a book that said, it was titled "Why Was I Adopted?"
Yeah,
I don't remember what it says, but
they put it on your bed.
Yeah, that it existed. But yeah, it was not a huge deal to meet my birth family, because I'm very thankful to my birth mom that, you know, she was young and birth father was young, and they weren't married, and
they couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, I'm very thankful for them to put me up for adoption, and that I was adopted by a great family. But you know, it was interesting experience to meet them, and yeah, we looked a ton alike, except that they were all normal sized and not.
You're giant.
I think my two biological brothers were like really happy that I didn't grow up as their big brother.
Just wailing on them.
Yeah.
Has some of your biological family seen some of the stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, they knew a ton about me. Like they had been.
Yeah, because you're all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah, but so that was cool to get to you know their story and stuff.
Was that ever a negative or hurtful thing as a kid growing up?
No.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, I have two older brothers. Much older brothers than me, and yeah, they just used to like, you know, beat me up a lot when I was little and stuff.
Yeah,
but
cool,
it's great. So
yeah, everybody needs an ass whooping every once in a while. What else?
I got bigger than them when I was like 14 years old. So
there you go. Return the favor.
Yeah,
you into anything else other than lifting, or is lifting just your life, and that's where you're at?
Yeah, like I'd say lifting is my hobby. Yeah, you know, the business of Juggernaut is really my greater focus now, and I enjoy competing and doing that. But it's not a huge, you know, it doesn't take up nearly as big a portion of my energy or my own training doesn't take up that much of my energy or attention as I think people think it might.
Yeah.
They're probably a lot of people may be under the impression that Juggernaut is like a bigger operation because, you know, we are all over the internet or whatever.
Right.
But up until...
Social media is awesome, you know?
Yeah. Up until last year, it was really... you know,
just me, you.
Me at Juggernaut World Headquarters, which was my couch.
Yeah, of course. Here I am at HQ. Yeah.
Social media multiple.
Like, wow, that looks like a home. Oh, it kind of is. That's pretty cool. And so what fascinates you about business?
It's just a new challenge. You know, my degree is in history, which doesn't get put
That's
to
in
use
the past, though.
Ever.
Ba-doom. That was good.
And so it's just been a new challenge, and it's... Yeah, it's very fun to get to make, you know, your passion your work, and you know, you've been able to do the same thing. It's I'd encourage anyone to, if they have a real passion in life and they're not happy with, you know, what they're doing, sitting at a desk 9 to 5, whatever it may be, chase that passion. And you know, I don't go in much for like motivational, inspirational kind of stuff, but it takes a lot of courage to do that. And whatever it is, whether it's lifting,
it does. It can be scary for people to, and I have, you know, Chris Duffin is somebody who just recently quit his, you know, his high paying regular job, you know, to follow his passion in, you know, the strength community, and to try to, he's got an invention out, and he's trying to do a lot of different things, and you got to admire that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know, whether it's school or it's training, it's business, whatever it might be for people, it takes a great amount of courage to chase, you know, real greatness in whatever it is, because most people don't understand that, and they don't understand, you know, selling out, you know, towards your goal, like ultimate dedication to that. And people almost, they look down on it. Why are you training so much? That's a waste of time. Why are you working so hard? They don't get that.
When you're a little bit popular, people applaud it. But once you get to be really popular, people start to hate it.
Yeah. I think at the very, very outset of it, the people, a lot of times if people don't have a good support system around them, there are people, you know, you can't do that. You're not going to make it, whatever it, you know. So I applaud people.
Do you
and
use some of that
people.
As motivation, you know, in business and in lifting, as people telling you kind of can't, or does that just bounce off you? Don't give a fuck about it.
Yeah, you know, I've been very fortunate to have, you know, incredibly supportive family around me, and they've always, whatever it is I want to do, they were very supportive of that, and I, you know, huge thanks to my parents and my brothers for that. So that's not something I've had to deal with a ton, fortunately, but. Yeah, the lifting stuff. I think there are a lot of guys out there. You know, they do powerlifting, you know, because they're angry about something, or it has a bigger meaning to them. Like, I do powerlifting because I like the challenge of lifting more weight.
Right.
Yeah, but it's a sport. Like, it's not some life metaphor for me or anything. I just lift weights and then
it's kind of refreshing.
Yeah. Oh, well, it is cool though. You can take the discipline from the training that you did for shot put and that you did for. Or that you're currently doing for powerlifting and throw it into your juggernaut.
Yeah, juggernaut's really my passion. I love, you know, getting out there and sharing information with people and helping, you know, whether training is that life metaphor for them or they just want to get better at their sport, whatever it is, you know, equipping them with some tools to better do that.
Well, I think that's pretty much it, I think, unless you guys have any other questions for them.
That's a good place to wrap it up right there.
Where can people find you?
Okay, lots of places. Juggernaut Training Systems on Facebook, JTSstrength.com, so two S's in a row in the middle there, at Juggernaut Training on Instagram, at Chad Wesley Smith on Instagram. I like to use three names for extra professionalism.
Yeah, it's fancy.
And Chad Smith is like the most regular white guy name ever.
He's the drummer from Red Hot Chili Peppers, I think.
Yeah, plus if you ever want to be an assassin, you're in there right there with three names.
Yeah, I think it's more serial killers who get three names, but... hopefully avoid that part of the three name crew. And so all of those places, go all check it out. I'll fill up your news feed and stuff all day, hopefully with very useful information.
He's working on ramping up his YouTube and always doing stuff on social media. Self-made man here with Chad Wesley Smith. He's pumping out a lot of information on the Instagrams and on Twitter and on fucking Facebook and anywhere else you can find any form of social media. He is kind of everywhere and anywhere. So make sure you check out some of his stuff. I'm at Mark Smelly Bell. Multiply your hustle, multiply your muscle, and that's it for me.
Man,
all your shits be tapered. I almost forgot.
Well, no.
That would have been the first time. People would have tried. Yeah. At Silent Mike with 2Ks on Instagram and Twitter. And head over to iTunes and give us a review. Share this shit. A lot of knowledge here in this building. Mostly in this big head to my right.
Oh, my God. That's a huge head. 18 pounds? No, 16 pounds?
I don't think that was calibrated. Yeah, we need to.
That's the juggernoggin.
That's 36 pounds or so, at least.
Yeah. All right, I'm Jim McD, STTV, everywhere that I would want you to find me. Follow the show on Instagram, at Mark Bell's Powercast, Twitter, at STJimSack, Facebook.com/SupertrainingJim. And we'll catch you next time.
Thank you.
Subscribe to Power Magazine at thepowermagazine.com. If you choose the digital edition, you can catch up on all the great back issues, take your training to the next level with Slingshot products at howmuchyoubench.net, and look for PSN products including NO Explode at bodybuilding.com. Mark Bell's Power.